We acknowledge that we are on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' spirit, imagination, and rich history of storytelling and humour that is an inspiration for all Australians.
Hello and welcome to the released desperately close to the Comedy Festival version of The Bearer of Weird News. I am your host and rain slicker in the flood of news, Matt Harvey. I'd like to say first and foremost big thanks to everyone who came out to the Adelaide Fringe, everyone who came out to see my show, and who supported just live comedy, supported the Fringe, and came out and did a thing. It was just so nice to see you all. It was nice to speak to those of you who hung around after the show to share some of your stories about crap jobs that you've had or things that you've seen. And it's just been a fantastic time. I've got another run of my Wage Against the Machine show in the Melbourne Fringe Festival starting very soon, running until the 23rd of April. And then it'll be off to Edinburgh in August with last year's show, the I Got Bit by Monkey Once, the storytelling show that I've talked about nonstop for the last year or so. So if you happen to be in Edinburgh, if you know anyone who's going that way, feel free to send them my way. If you are in Melbourne and if you want to come see the show in the Comedy Festival, for being loyal listeners or stumbling upon this particular episode for the first time, you can use the code word ANTIWORK, ANTIWORK, to get 25% off full price tickets to my show Wage Against the Machine for this upcoming comedy festival. But for now, I will be the bearer of weird news. Let's get into it. First, we're getting into the headlines. A study from New Scientist suggests that people are more overly trusting of what they see online based on the fact that they are bad at spotting fake LinkedIn profiles generated by an AI. I mean, of course, who could spot a fake LinkedIn profile? No human being has ever looked at a LinkedIn profile. It'd be like expecting people to recognize a fake eel birth ritual. You can't recognize that which we have never seen. LinkedIn is just a bunch of drones pretending to be humans, trying to fool other drones into believing that they are genuinely working. So they've actually perfectly recreated the office environment. It's actually pretty impressive. New data from a scientific accident has suggested that life may actually flash before our eyes as we die. And I was ready and willing to be excited by this new discovery, as horrifying as the idea of reliving my minimum wage years in some sort of cruel cosmic joke is. But the BBC's use of inverted commas around the word accident has me a little concerned. As the team of scientists apparently set out to measure the brain waves of an 87-year-old patient who had developed epilepsy. But during the neurological recording, he suffered a fatal, not at all on purpose, to make a new scientific discovery that we can publish in this publish or peril scientific rat race that we call a culture, heart attack, offering an unexpected recording of a dying brain, making Dr. Ajmal Zamar, a co-author of the study's testimony, that this was actually totally by chance. We did not plan this experiment or to record these signals. Less and less convincing as the police closed in on him to arrest him finally. Dr. Zamar and his team have cautioned that broad conclusions can't be drawn from a study of one, and plans on studying many others in their last moments, in many different ways. Poison, starvation, stabbing, gunshot, and slowly watching the life fade out of their eyes as they breathe their last breath through the crushed windpipes that you can feel under your mighty godlike hands. But it's all for science. Science and nothing else. The Tasmanian tiger species could be brought back to life by scientists at the University of Melbourne in a new world-class research lab. Researchers from the Institute of Lazy and Terrible Backronyms are set to work to reverse the extinction of the thylacine in the Thylacine Integrated Genetic Restoration Research, or the TIGER Lab. Look, I get it, science. It's fun to have fun, but you've got to put a little more work into it than that, alright? The thylacine went extinct in 1936, so reintegrating it into modern society might prove complicated, as it retains no idea of the value of a current dollar, will just be given its home, and might use outdated slang and terminology. We will begin their return by placing them within retirement homes where they can collect franking credits and complain about the way language has changed with their fellow boomers until sufficient new generations are born, and then they form an empathetic relationship with their environment and give speeches at important world summits, shitting on their leaders over their inaction to bring them back sooner. I think it seems appropriate. Recruitment company and founder Serena Russo, Australia's 50th richest woman, has released a video of herself calling for flood victims in Queensland and New South Wales to exercise in order to get endorphins and feel better. Anyone who has spent time at her recruitment company can tell you this isn't the first time that Serena Russo has failed to be useful to people who have lost everything. Fortunately for the 99%, raising up and striking down with a decapitating axe is also considered exercise. A new report titled the Energy Transitions Commission Report has warned removing carbon dioxide from the air will now be essential if there is to be any chance of meeting global climate targets. A fun opportunity for billionaires desperate to prove that they are useful to society and their inventions are in fact good and won't leave the Earth an unlivable hellhole on the scale so high that it's preferable to live in a company town on Mars than to stay here another day. As offsets will form a critical route to limiting global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, the report says carbon offset markets will need to be tidied up and managed properly, and other methods such as tree planting and carbon capture and storage will also be critical. Other options in descending order of believability and likelihood include time travel, Genghis Khan attack, a Hail Mary attempt to produce a new ant babies with an ant orgy, building a giant Henry the Hoover in a geosynchronous orbit over the most polluting countries and businesses, voting in politicians willing to take significant action on climate change, and global disaster management, sending billionaires to space and then redistributing their wealth into a sovereign wealth fund to save the globe. A Senate inquiry into definitions of meat and other animal products initiated by the National Party of New Zealand recommends the government implement mandatory food labelling requirements which may force plant-based food manufacturers to change the way they label their products. Well, we wouldn't want those big burly men to be confused when they go and bite into a brontosaurus rib and instead they're accidentally eating an entire rack of fern tree instead. That'd be awful. The naming of non-product products has caused something of a headache for linguists and language pedants alike, who insist that language remain vacuum, sealed for freshness, so that anyone who happens to awaken from a 50-year coma can walk straight back into society without noticing any kind of change at all. And wouldn't that be best for everyone? Recent product naming changes have included non-French champagne, racially charged cheeses, and lollies, and classification for persons being kept in hotel detention. Remember, refugees can only be named such if they come from the refuge region of the atrocity they are fleeing from. More than a month after an errant rocket stage was spotted tumbling towards the moon, experts say that it is almost certainly crashed into the lunar surface. NASA scientists announced that they have been monitoring the moon for any changes caused by the impact and released the first footage of the crash. Do we have a clip? Australian Environment Minister Susan Ley announced the removal of humpback whales from the endangered wildlife list. She said they were thriving, like the not-at-all-endangered barrier reef. With the whale out of immediate danger, the government will be rushing the process to kick it off the welfare benefits that it has been receiving previously and will likely have to pay some of it back, as they have clearly been doing better than they've been previously stating and have been sucking off the welfare state like some sort of parasite for way too long. And given it's been doing double duty as both a whale and a parasite, it hadn't previously declared such and will be being audited by the government to claw back any and all excess health and well-being that it has taken unduly for redistribution among one of the many other endangered species that Australia has been cultivating recently. The Department of Homeland Security recently released images of robot dogs patrolling the US-Mexico border, revealing details about how they're testing the technology. Officials praised the robot's potential as a force multiplier that could boost Border Patrol agents' safety by reducing their exposure to life-threatening hazards. Hazards they put in place by enforcing a stricter border conditions, stopping people from returning home after working in the country, ramping up national supplies of xenophobia, and fueling wars in foreign countries through drug use, seeking cheaper drugs, and the easy access of guns and weapons flowing back across the border to intimidate locals who are seeking refuge from the violence. The introduction of robot dogs as police support will clear the one remaining issue holdouts have with the philosophy of ACAB, which is that regular dogs are just loyal idiots doing what they think is helpful, like cops themselves, but without the ability to moralize. So, still like cops, really. But we are obsessed with dogs being good boys and putting them all out of work, we can further sympathise with our out-of-employment best friends as we split a welfare check and complain about robots taking our jobs, further solidifying the bond of man and dog to form a formidable team when the uprising comes. Arf, arf, comrades, arf, arf. Workers in Belgium will soon be able to choose a 4-day work week under a reform package agreed to by the country's multi-party coalition government. Upon hearing that, under these reforms, civil servants working for Belgium's federal government were given the right to disconnect, allowing them to turn off work devices and ignore messages after hours without reprisal, Scott Morrison called an emergency meeting of National Cabinet and his party to talk about the possibility of introducing similar laws for Australian Parliament. But only Australian Parliament. You still gotta respond to calls from his boss, Harvey Norman. And now, onto the news. First up, government spending news. Defence Minister and human face in the process of imploding in on itself to consolidate its power to maximum levels, Peter Dutton, and fellow MP and man who will not tell you again it is past your bedtime, Mr. Luke Howarth, sparked an online backlash for setting up GoFundMe pages in the wake of the recent Queensland and New South Wales floods. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, has defended Dutton's fundraising efforts, saying he was surprised at the backlash and Dutton was, like any MP, doing their job. I mean, that being deferring the maximum amount of government funding as possible into strategic electorates while paving over the gaping holes in government with unpaid volunteer work and donations from charities and private citizens. The true work of government. Think of this GoFundMe page as the privately bought and installed solar panels to the increasingly shrinking development funding of the solar solution to climate crisis in Australia. Government officials were heard asking questions like, why is this a federal government responsibility? Because it happened in Australia? And reminding people times have changed. That's old school thinking. We were merely... the custodians of the land, I think you'll find we have acknowledged the traditional owners of the land, the indigenous people, and so it'll be up to them to sort out the problem. We're merely the real estate agents. We will, however, pass on the message. These floods seemingly are a situation that should necessitate the release of emergency funds by Australia's Emergency Response Fund, which currently contains $4.7 billion for those sorts of, you know, one-off events. However, as these events are increasingly common, with a list of once-in-a-lifetime events coming down at first to twice-in-a-lifetime and then once-in-a-decade and now thrice-yearly events, and something that happens that frequently just can't legally be classified as an emergency. It's just an occurrence. We used to think of the overturning of the political leader by their party as an emergency, but it's been downsized to just a national kerfuffle. Which is why the Emergency Response Fund has paid out $0 so far. In fact, the response to such events in such a non-emergency, in the eyes of Scott Morrison and friends, that they've not even rolled out the Defence Force at any kind of pace, instead chiding the idea, saying the Defence Force is not available on a moment's notice to respond to floods. Rambling on that always there will be community response in disasters such as this, because the community is already there. The resources move, and they come as you see them now, but they are not available on a moment's notice. It is unrealistic to have that set as an expectation. It has taken everybody, including the community, by surprise. No one expected to get to those levels. And I, for one, am inclined to believe him. Sure, we have an entire government department dedicated to national flood forecasting and warning, which lets us know that weather events are coming and who were giving warnings in the lead-ups to the very floods in question. But we've known since before he was elected that one Scott Morrison doesn't go in for warnings about the environment. He has openly mocked attempts to improve the environment, lowering our environmental impact and the idea of positive action, and we voted him in anyway. He was doing what the people voted him in to do. This is democracy in action, people. This is what you voted for. And it's hard to blame the coalition for being hesitant to use public funds to achieve anything. They've been following through on their instincts on how to spend money, and where has it led them? To public outrage and scrutiny. And nobody wants public outrage nor scrutiny. The natural inclination for eating pork in a barrel has led them to a state launching an inquiry into the politicization of research grants. And they hate being investigated. They just cannot stand it. And then the audit office accused federal grants programs of favoring coalition-held seats. They've had to sit and think about who is a selfish scoundrel that people love. One so selfish and uninclined to action that doesn't directly impact them yet is universally praised. Who is this narcissistic messiah that they could model themselves on? George Costanza. This was supposed to be the summer of Scott. They were supposed to float out of a pandemic that they did nothing to stop and straight into a vote, not be shirt-fronted by a climate catastrophe that they failed to do anything about. All of their instincts are wrong, and they need to go full Costanza on this whole thing. They need to follow the opposite of their natural instinct. Are you inclined to spend money on helping? Don't do it. Do the opposite. Slow roll out the ADF and say that there was no way to know that this would happen. Have the inclination for a photo shoot? Nope. Go into an area and instead say you'll speak to people, and when the flood impacted locals request to speak to you, ignore them. What are they gonna say, Jerry? That's wet. Yeah, I know it's wet. We all know it's wet. Instead, just show up to your job and have a nap under your desk. The day will end eventually and you'll get to go home. Don't worry about the children in the fire. Simply push them down and get yourself to a safe place at the top of a pile of money. Can't drown if you build your own hill of money. It's simple economics, people. You want something safe to stand on when the floods come in, get that money stacked sky high. No wonder they're keen to pork barrel their own electorates. They need that money to stand on. Twitter doing some good news. Twitter, humanity's emergency reserve of raw, unfiltered, uneducated fury. A Twitter bot has been revealing the gender pay gap at UK-based brands who celebrated International Women's Day with the IWD 2022 hashtag by showing the rate the company is paying their female employees compared to their male employees, which, given their willingness to flaunt that they are such strong allies, shouldn't uncover any dirty secrets at all, he asked, with no ulterior motive or revelation lined up in the script. When one of those companies tweeted with the hashtag, the bot used publicly available information from the government database that records differences in pay between men and women in the UK companies with more than 250 employees. Like the Terminator was sent back in time with the mission of ensuring that the future had as many saviors. There'll be some text on the screen and you'll see what I mean. As many saviors as it does saviors. But instead of shooting people, it's being snarky on Twitter. A majority of the bot's retweets revealed women's hourly median pay was lower than their male colleagues, often by about a third, which is why there is far less action hero females than there were men. Why would you force yourself into a position of enhanced responsibility, like some sort of savior of the future of humanity, if they won't even give you the basic courtesy of paying you a respectful wage? But then, things really got interesting when organizations tried to evade detection, like Newman University in Birmingham, who tweeted about celebrating the achievements of women everywhere today, only for the snitch bot to retweet with the helpful reminder, in this organization, women's median hourly pay is 18.6% lower than men's. Seems contradictory, but as the university is celebrating the achievements of women everywhere, the university is only one very small part of everywhere. They can't be expected to keep an eye on all of the misses in the entire world, even if they're happening inside their own house. So I think that's pretty reasonable. The university is, however, full of smart people who won't be defeated by a robot. They deleted the tweet and reposted without the IWD 2022 hashtag. And the game was officially on. The bot got smarter. The bot scans the username for any further tweets with relevant IWD keywords. Accounts ended up blocking the bot and even went to the trouble of making their tweets private, which is exactly what you should be doing with tweets that are celebrating your allyship, keeping them to yourself. The idea for the bot was conceived by one of its creators, Francesca Lawson, while having to write corporate promotional material for International Women's Day, while knowing that the company she was writing about was paying women less than men. Facing the age-old nemesis of women the world over since the Garden of Eden, knowledge. I mean, if we're being honest, and they'd not gone to the trouble of educating themselves through various methods such as computers, reading, and the consumption of fruits and vegetables. Just remember, kids, if your mum tells you to eat your fruits, and you need to consider carrying the burden of knowledge. Though, as one who is yet to receive the curse of knowledge, it's impossible to fully weigh the depth of that choice. And so the cycle continuously perpetuates itself. Ah, knowledge, you are crafty. If you don't insist on knowing so much, then you wouldn't know how much you're missing out on. I mean, come on, women. It's basic economics. And like Arnold Schwarzenegger, the bot may be back. to make the point that women earning significantly less than their male colleagues are effectively working for free through the final weeks and months of the year. The companies are keen to equalize that pay structure, not by reducing the pay gap in favor of women, but by reducing pay for men and widening the frontline worker CEO pay gap. Around October is the time that women start working for free, and CEOs would like men to do their part for gender equality by also working for free from October. Maybe even bringing it back a little to make up for, you know, the past by working for free from like July next year, just in solidarity. As there are more workers in frontline positions than CEOs, they will not be partaking in the salary sacrifice so as to maximize the benefit. Or don't you believe in equality, men? Is it all just words and pageantry? Now's your time to show your support for women. We believe in you. This will lift Australia's ranking in the World Economic Forum's Global Gender Gap Index. After we fell from 14th in 2014 to 70th in 2021 for economic participation and opportunity. But first in the index for women's education. So our women are dropping in the world rankings of opportunity and ability to participate, but boy, do they know about it. Oh, there's that pesky knowledge coming back to haunt our women again. Who would have guessed it? Women in Australia should not worry. Australia is such a good country for women. After all, we don't even shoot our women when they are marching for basic human rights, unlike some other countries who will remain nameless. And we aren't even the worst. We ranked equal with the UK on a gender pay gap scorecard across six countries, trailing France, South Africa, Spain, and Sweden. I mean, equal last. That's not bad, right? It's not last, that's for sure. We aren't the clear losers, and show that, you know, we've been strong supporters for the government's more recent It's Not a Race strategy for many years leading up to the vaccine rollout. We're just not about rolling things out quickly, okay? Russia News Now, also known as the Cold War II Sanction Town News. War! What is it good for? Lining the pockets of weapons manufacturers, puffing up the international image of despots and less despot world leaders, and destabilizing international trade, people's homes and lives, justifying price gouging even when you have limited to no connection to Russian and Ukrainian markets, and justifying outrageous spending on war machines. Good God, Joel! Russia continues its somewhat expected invasion of Ukraine and, somewhat expectedly, social media falling in love with the comedian-turned-president your electorate told you not to worry about, Volodymyr Zelensky. Ooh. Hello, Volodymyr. Welcome to the party. Everybody is looking at you now. But the war hasn't been all predictable response and Ukrainian flag emojis. There has been a lot of unexpected responses and some kick-ass stories. Obviously, we're not going to be able to talk about the entire Ukrainian-Russian conflict. That's not really this podcast's area of expertise. So we're going to take a little look at some of the stranger occurrences that have come out of the Russian-Ukrainian war. Like the Ukrainian woman who offered seeds to Russian soldiers to put in their pockets. A seemingly innocuous gesture that you'd be forgiven for assuming was possibly a harmless local custom or gesture, until she quickly informed the soldiers that it was so sunflowers would grow when they die. And this elderly Ukrainian resident, who was filmed reprimanding Russian soldiers by reminding them, "You have your own country," which is just beautiful. Such a simple idea. So good. A sentiment the current Russian president, a man who definitely hogs the blankets at night, Vladimir Putin, would respond to, "Yes, and soon we will have more of it back again." I imagine he's whistling the Paul McCartney confusing banger Back in the USSR, mostly the part that says, "You don't know how lucky you are, back in the USSR, back in the USS, back in the USS, back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are," over and over and over and over again. Though this Ukrainian man does not agree, and has taken a firm anti-USSR stance by offering to tow a Russian tank back to Russia after it ran out of fuel in the street, while the Western world is imposing severe and united sanctions on Russia in sectors ranging from finance to aviation, Western governments have avoided sanctioning energy exports from Russia, seeking to protect their citizens from price spikes, despite the fact that this has gone and happened regardless. Early word has just come in from BP that they are using these incidents to form the basis of their latest ad campaign. Fuel price hikes have made life hard for many of us. Not many of us. Many of you. Possibly paying more than you earn per hour to pay to get to work. Struggling to do basics like drive to the shops for food. BP hears you, and BP wants you to remember that you aren't the only one not getting fuel. Neither is this Russian tank. And by BP keeping the prices so high, nobody can afford to get where they are going. And as such, BP will be continuing to keep prices so high, nobody can afford to get where they're going. See, the fuel hikes aren't all bad, and may even save a life. BP, we need to go beyond petroleum in order to get anywhere at the moment. And while BP has responded to this whole adieu by selling its nearly 20% ownership in Russian state-owned energy giant Rosneft, sanctions remain strong and have caused Russia to ask China for military equipment to use in its invasion of Ukraine. White House National Security Advisor and man who puts the face in Face the Nation, Jake Sullivan, bluntly warned China to avoid helping Russia evade punishment from global sanctions that have hammered the Russian economy, in the largest attempt to induce reverse psychology, finally giving them an excuse to sanction China without being the bad guys. You know they want to do it. You just know that they want to. In its sanction efforts, the United States launched a corruption task force to further strain the finances of Russia's oligarchs to pressure the country to cease its invasion of Ukraine. The US, of course, has a deep understanding of how important it is when you have a upper class of billionaires who not so secretly run everything to keep feeding them from the bottomless money trough, though you must be at least this rich to access the money trough. The task force, known as Klepto Capture, and an interagency law enforcement group dedicated to enforcing sanctions, export restrictions, and economic countermeasures designed to freeze Russia out of global markets. A tactic generally reserved for the working class, but they've spent years developing it and are ready to ramp it up a notch. Finally turn it on to somebody who deserves it for once. The US Justice Department says it has long had a team to track down assets belonging to kleptocrats from around the globe that are linked to crimes with an impact on the US financial system, such as money laundering, sanctions, evasion or foreign bribes. Wait, so they've been able to do this for a long time? Because I could have sworn that every time we ask governments to do this in non-war times to punish those who've gained wealth via troublesome means like exploiting their workers, there's been no response. Not even an auto reply from government agencies. The task force will be staffed by agents and analysts from a variety of law enforcement agencies, including the FBI, the US Marshals, the Secret Service, Homeland Security Investigations, IRS Criminal Investigations, and the US Postal Inspection Service. Word is that this is why Mr. Zip hasn't been seen in public for so long. He went underground to start this whole task force. He is the man in black for Russian oligarchs. If you think you saw him, you didn't. It's a matter of national security. Non-US world leaders have had a mixed response to the event, with China having officially not taken a side yet, and Belarus, Syria, North Korea, and Eritrea all voting against a UN General Assembly resolution demanding Russia end the war. Although 35 countries were in absentia, like cowards. There's a lot you can say about North Korea, and you should. What are they going to do? Leave and come and find you? No, that's not going to happen. But at least they have the courage of their lack of convictions. They didn't conveniently not attend the day of the big test like a year 10 student in maths class. So, if nothing else, and there shouldn't be, kudos to them for that. This is such an unexpected narrative shift. Even the Swiss might actually get involved. Yeah, crazy. Famously neutral Switzerland, who, when faced with the decision to stand against Nazi fascism in World War II, they said, nah, we'll just be the laundering and hiding of stolen golden treasures guys, while insisting that we are neutral. After all, if you had stolen gold, Allied forces, they'd hide and launder them for you as well. But this invasion is going too far. They haven't even offered to hide gold in Swiss banks. How are we going to remain neutral if nobody offers us to hide stolen gold and treasures? It's just not possible. I mean, even the Taliban is calling for peace in Ukraine. They've spent years working to become synonymous with instability in the European supercontinent, only for America to up and leave them and be openly flirting with another war right in front of them? This isn't Instagram, where you go out of your way to show how good your life is in the month immediately following a breakup, posting lots of war thirst traps with your new arch rival. That's not how this goes down. Former world invasion champions circa roughly 1490 to 1960, Britain, are unimpressed with this potential resurgence of longtime rivals Russia. For a franchise regroup which is focused not on the former Britain as it ages out of the role of empire holder, and instead focuses on the side character Russia's son's journey through the high-stakes world of invasion and war. It's embarrassing for everybody, really. Prime Minister and Muppet enthusiast Boris Johnson has condemned the depraved Russian attack on a maternity hospital. And if there is one thing that this guy, Boris Johnson, cares about, it's children. He has to. Who knows which one of them are his? Can't just have it come on out that he was cruel to one of his own children through negligence by an act of not bothering to learn if the child was his. That is why they supported allowing poor school children to go without food at school. It teaches them the most important lesson they will learn. Nobody will care about you but yourself. Take what you can and fuck them all. This way, the upcoming generations will not be inclined to be more empathetic than the one before them, ensuring that they won't shame the past by virtue of being kinder and more considerate of the planet. Well played. Well played. But efforts to curb the war and Russian influence around the world have begun, so we can return to our rapidly returning complacency and not think about the need to change the world for anybody at all, anywhere. We started by rolling out some of our toughest consequences. Yeah, that's right. Compare the Market has pulled their meerkat ads from TV. I just didn't think I'd live to see the day, to be honest. The comparison site is looking to avoid comparisons, ironically, to Russian oligarchs by saying fictional Russian billionaire Alexander Orlov has no association with the current situation. Meaning they really want us to know that his wealth was not obtained the oligarch way. scrambling, sometimes violently, for power when the Soviet Union fell, to take ownership of the country's industrial infrastructures by any means necessary, resulting in these individuals amassing significant wealth and ending up with the power necessary to manipulate the government. No. They did it the Western way. Scrambling, sometimes emotionally violently, for power when a business is struggling, taking ownership of that business or undercutting them through duplicitous tactics by any means necessary, resulting in these individuals amassing significant wealth and ending up with the power to manipulate the government, which makes him a billionaire and not an oligarch. Learn your terms, children. Orlov has amassed enough power and influence that his catchphrase, Simples, became so widespread it was included in the Collins English Dictionary in 2010. No word yet on whether Collins, out of an abundance of caution, will be removing the word from the dictionary until such times as people forget that they were angry at Russia in the first place. Though that prompts further exploration, if we, as a species, are cracking down on words and their usage, like British supermarkets who came under pressure on social media to rename their chicken Kievs to chicken Kievs to show solidarity with the Ukraine, whose capital is Kiev in Ukrainian. Sorry, is Kiev in Ukrainian and Kiev in Russian. When will we be removing more Russian words from the dictionary? Lest they be caught spying on us in our most intimate and vulnerable moments, like playing Scrabble or Wordle. That's a contemporary reference. Words like oligarch, which we will be required to stop using as it reminds us of the troubles in Russia, and we will have to refer to oligarchs simply as billionaires. We will then encourage, through social media pressure, young radical leftists to drop their Russian popularized ideals and influences, throw off their shackles of communism and socialism, and attach the golden shackles of hard capitalism and neoliberalism. Like the children of free-loving hippies becoming the generation that popularized Wall Street's greed is good mindset. Makes sense to me. The invasion of Ukraine has put the spotlight on firms using or selling products that might be associated with the conflict or Russia, or supporting the Russian war effort. Except for Raytheon, who still have yet to be questioned on their contribution to the war, their stance on peace, and if they think they should pull out of the country. I'm expecting a public press release from them any moment. Though Raytheon isn't alone, as Burger King is still operating in Russia. Though, as a monarch-run business, the ability to empathize with those suffering and not just do whatever you want isn't something that is to be thought about, really. And war is generally the way to expand empire. It's the way of the monarch of old. It's the way that they did it, and it's the way these new monarchs will do it as well. Oh, and then there's Subway, who's still operating there. But I guess Subway has dealt with like much more complicated social pressures in the past and has managed to navigate its way out of it. I suspect we'll be eating fresh again. But we have started hitting Russians hard. First off, Slack started to disconnect customers in Russia. Yeah, how will employers force their employees to go back to work during an active war when they can't access Slack? It's not going to happen, is it? Are they going to use Microsoft Teams? I don't think so. Those alerts are way too annoying. And besides, Microsoft has cut off access, so that's not going to happen. No point microchipping everybody if they all die in a world war. That, my friends, is a bad investment. The world is taking a strange and interesting shape as the war in Ukraine continues, and another unexpected ally is performing support, as FIFA suspends Russia from playing in the World Cup. Yeah, FIFA. Seems Russia will have to follow the American model of only playing themselves, but still calling it the World Cup, but in this case, they'll call it the Universe Cup, to be better than the Americans. they are already using the American model of justifying an invasion, so why not do the sports model as well? A statement from FIFA and UEFA read, "Football is fully united here and in full solidarity with all the people affected in Ukraine. Both presidents hope that the situation in Ukraine will improve significantly and rapidly so that the football can again be a vector for unity and peace amongst people." Ah, yes, football. Unity for peace. Have we got some footage of football being a unity of peace among people? Can we just have a look at that?
Clashes erupted in Paris due to soccer fans celebrating the France World Cup victory.
Such a unity of peace. But don't fear, this is an entire 180 from the notorious sports organization / casual human rights violator. No. The World Cup will still be held in Qatar, despite the human rights record, the treatment of women, and the commonness of indentured servitude under the hot Qatar sun. No need to worry that things will change in a way that will expect you to become more compassionate or seriously change your worldview for the better or for the worse. Normalcy will soon be returned. But first, before normalcy can return, Canadian liquor stores will be removing Russian vodka from shelves. Visa and MasterCard will both suspend operations in Russia, and power companies McDonald's, Starbucks, Coca-Cola, and Pepsi have all suspended Russian operations, with McDonald's saying restaurant closures in Russia will cost the chain $50 million a month. Information that they definitely could have kept on the down low and just done the right thing to help support the people of Ukraine and put a speedy end to the war, but you know, good on you, weird flex and all, but thanks. I expect that Burger King restaurants will start to set up shop within the shell of former McDonald's restaurants, like hermit crabs finding new shells after having a bunch of babies and having to find new shells for all those babies. This is the final stage of what they're calling Operation Who's Loving It Now, huh? Who's Loving It Now? Notably, you don't see Goldman Sachs bragging about how much it will cost them to support the people in Ukraine when they move employees out of Russia and over to Dubai. Ah, yes, respectable old Dubai. Definitely no human rights issues there. Neither Goldman Sachs nor Dubai have ever done anything outside of the considered boundaries of acceptable behaviour, so it's reasonable to expect that everything will be fine by the meeting of these two power players. No issues at all. Some groups have committed to show their indifference to the matter, as Hungary said it will not send troops or weapons to Ukraine and will not allow lethal weapons to transit its territory in order to keep the country safe. Well, to be fair, with Switzerland relinquishing its status as a neutral country, somebody needs to start filling the gap. Nature abhors a vacuum, and nothing creates a vacuum quite like peace. Space is peaceful. This vacuous peace has been terrible for the continued existence and creation of new life. So we must not let the vacuum of space spread unchecked into our countries. Cryptocurrency, the Tinkerbell of financial models, in that occasionally you need to shout that you do believe in crypto, you do believe in crypto, you do believe in crypto, in order to stop it from dying, has also contributed, with the Bored Ape Yacht Club announced that it donated $1 million in Ethereum to Ukraine. If it is as effective as they're announcing that NFTs are a thing or that crypto is money, then there likely isn't anything to actually donate, but the belief that they are donating. But hey, a bunch of people do believe that there is something to donate. So therein lies the most important donation of all. The suckers that we made along the way. Seems though we've found the one group doing less for the Ukraine than cryptocurrency, And who is it? Who could it possibly be? Oh my, it's the Australian government. Yep, no big surprise there. With two powerful Russian oligarchs with ties to Australia's fossil fuel sector yet to face sanctions despite being targeted in the US and the UK, which is unusual for us. We generally do what our big brothers US and UK do. We even formed the awkwardly named AUKUS alliance, which, as far as I understand, is a loose arrangement of submarine swaps. I think that's what's going on there. Russian company Rusal, one of the world's largest aluminium companies, has a 20% stake in Queensland Alumina Limited, a Ukrainian-born Vector Vexelberg, who, fun fact, owns more Fabergé eggs than anyone in the world, made his cash in aluminium, or aluminium. Let's go with aluminium. And now owns the vast conglomerate Renova Group, who have their fingers in a lot of pies, including all of Russia's international airports. In short, he's very rich. The Vexelberg-controlled Lamesa Holdings has a 16% stake in Falcon Oil and Gas, which is engaged in a joint venture with Origin Energy over exploration in the Beetaloo Basin, one of the most promising shale gas resources anywhere in the world. How lucky we are. And as we are being pressured to reduce our reliance on coal by 2050, not the year, I mean just like in 24 hour time, so by 2050 tonight, whenever it is that you're listening to this, and it's probably the only way that we'd actually end up being able to start to implement an impactful reduction on emissions is to start at 2050 tonight and not in 28 years. Because that might be a little bit problematic. Vexelberg also sits on Falcon's board. Now, the Morrison government wants to unlock the Beetaloo Basin for fracking as part of its gaslight-led recovery, where we continue to be a dad, blaming the continued release of environmental damaging gas on the nearby dog as it can't defend itself. Meanwhile, our children see right through the, for lack of a better word, deception, and continue to insist if you won't take credit for the damage you've done, we'll be forced to take drastic action. Meanwhile, Dad is suiting up to fly all the houses that he owns into space for the terraforming of Mars in the climate-controlled air conditioning, leaving no houses for the kids to live in. Typical. Origin Energy has tried to downplay the extent of its ties to Vexelberg, noting it had significant control over the joint venture rather than Falcon. Vexelberg would simply benefit from the deal, making no direct contribution, which means that he has already begun his transition into the gas-led recovery and is feeding the dog new dog food in preparation of giving him a right proper blaming while guzzling up the gas and economic benefits of said gas. Yum, yum, yum. Num, 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 num. But hey, they would comply also with any rules set by the government with respect to restrictions. If only they bothered to make any. Ugh, but seeing as no one's made any rules, we couldn't possibly just do it on our own. We need to be told. We need to be told because we're a bit dumb. We're a bit dumb in the head. Oh, wait, breaking news. This just in, yes, and the teleprompter is changing before my very eyes. Ah, yes, Australia will now sanction these two oligarchs. Whoopsie doodle! Seems Australia just simply forgot to include the two very well known and deeply entrenched into Australian industry oligarchs. That happens! It happens! Come on, guys. Don't be all cynical. It happens. It's the same old story. Bury someone in enough paperwork and eventually you forget exactly where you buried them and it becomes really hard to dig them up again when it's time to deal with the police. You know what I mean? Like, it's a tale as old as time. In a statement, Origin Energy said it was aware Mr. Vexelberg had been issued sanctions by Australia, but it was kind of dragged out like a teenager being reminded not to have a party by the parent before they go away for the weekend. Yes, Mum, I know, Mum. No dealings with the Russian oligarchs, Mum, while you're away at war. Jeez, I'm not a child, Mum. However, given that Origin Energy was the majority owner and operator when the Beetaloo Basin project encompassed, the company said that it would continue to have control over all activities. Smugly and with a note of condescending pride, saying, neither La Mesa Holdings nor Mr. Vexelberg are a part of the Beetaloo Basin joint venture. There, are you happy? Following up with a pretty lengthy and somewhat childish raspberry, and saying over and over again that Mr. Vexelberg wasn't taking any money and they were simply putting it in his pockets themselves. But he wasn't doing it just like the rules said. God. Speaking of Sydney, Foreign Minister Maurice Payne denied any suggestions that Australia had been too slow to act in sanctioning Mr. Vexelberg and Mr. Deprisaka. We're just doing it the Australian way. Slowly. Hoping nobody will pay attention to our failures to do it properly and then backflipping hard when we get caught and waving our arms in the air afterwards like it was a trick that we'd intended to do all along and no, a poorly deployed improvisation. Ta-da! That's the Australian way. And finally, one-off news. Josh Frydenberg, seen here struggling to demonstrate how small the newest benefits to welfare recipients will be, has revealed that Aussie workers who make up to $126,000 a year, so well below the rich threshold, according to Scott Morrison, will be eligible for a special cost of living support package to compensate for a higher cost of living in the next federal budget. The move comes as 5 million pensioners and welfare recipients received a boost to payments, with singles getting an extra $20 a fortnight and couples up to $30. And like the petulant children we are, we can't have poor people getting a thing without at least a bunch of us also getting something. You better believe this welfare announcement will infuriate your most distant childhood friends who you haven't blocked from social media because you went out drinking enough times to have a bit of a back catalogue of good memories to cushion the hatred for at least a little bit longer. The Treasurer said the nation is in a strong economic position on the heels of the COVID crisis, but warned Australia was not immune from international upheaval. It's good to start prepping excuses. Sprinkle a little international upheaval here and some national catastrophe there, and you can't be held accountable for anything, really. One of the reasons Frydenberg claims our economic position is strong is that while more than 1.62 million people were claiming welfare benefits at the peak of the COVID pandemic, the number has since dropped to 961,000. Saying it's a great sign for the Australian economy, claiming some economists could call it full employment today. And those economists would be wrong, see, because there's still a minimum of 961,000 people not employed, or they're in some form of underemployment, as is the hot new style of the modern age. But that's not what we'd realistically call full employment, unless you're an economist, I guess. And frankly, I blame George Jetson. The man from the future who only worked 9 hours a week, but they failed to mention that the pay was still enough that he could feed a family of four, a dog, and keep a robot slave operational. Whereas the worst people saw that and went, yeah, we should only pay them 9 hours worth of work a week. That's genius. Now, I know that the NAIRU, the lowest unemployment rate that is supposed to be sustainable without causing wages growth and inflation, was previously thought to be around 5%, though unemployment is currently at a record-breaking 4.2%, so maybe it's all nonsense? I don't know. I'm not an economist. I don't work with imaginary things like economies. I deal with real things, like jokes. Frydenberg has indicated but would not confirm whether pensioners would receive payments because they are due for their latest automatic increase that will be higher than in previous years due to growing inflation. They instead are waiting to see what the polling numbers come out like, and if the pensioner demographic is looking like it'll swing towards Labour or the Greens, like the poor and youth voters definitely will. Then they'll get into bribe mode. Sorry, bribes are illegal. Pork barreling mode. Pork barrels are just part of doing business. Right, Gladys? As part of extended pork barreling, Frydenberg did not rule out extending beyond June 30, 2023, the immediate expensing scheme introduced during the pandemic, which, in a predictable response, business groups want to be made permanent and the eligibility criteria extended, which is totally reasonable as it currently only impacts businesses with an aggregated turnover of less than 5 billion. 5 billion? That's not the really big end of town. How are you going to swing an election without including the biggest players in the town? Huh? This is amateur hour for seasoned pork barrelers like the Coalition. Really, you hate to see such amateur mistakes. Anyone would think this was a zero-time power holders like the Greens trying to get a taste of pork barreling for the first time. You hate to see the champions fall so hard. However, the ABC has understood that short-term gains of a one-off pork barrel will be offset by the long-term loss of the low and middle-income tax offset worth up to $1,080 a year, which was introduced 4 years ago as it had failed to garner then the support of the unwashed masses. They are clearly too stupid to see the support they've been receiving and will be much more impressed by a one-off and much more obvious payment. The cost of living bonus will be targeted at those hit hardest by the steeping price of petrol, groceries, health and housing. A one-off payment is definitely the best solution to the wild increasing costs of everyday living, such as petrol. And it is not like we need to think about the fact that a cost increase as small as a few dollars a litre has nearly completely destabilised the economy due to the stagnation of wages for the last 30 years because we got a shiny new one-off payment. Ha-ha! We haven't seen such cash splashing since the economy-destroying days of Kevin Rudd, keeping the economy out of a recession. You hate to see it. When announcing the latest decision on monetary policy on Melbourne Cup Day, the Reserve Bank noted that wages growth at the end of 2023 is expected to be running at 3%. This is higher than it is now. It is still below the average over the two decades to 2015. And this is a real key right here. That statement is the real key. In the past decade, inflation has risen 20%, and market sector productivity has increased 15%. But in that time, private sector wages have only gone up 25%. Now, that doesn't really sound like anything to most of us, but in effect, while that has covered inflation growth, workers have not been adequately rewarded for their increased productivity. Simply put, Australia's cost of living is outstripping wage increases, leaving the average worker more than $800 worse off in 2021. And sure, a lot of us were pretty unproductive in 2021, sitting in our homes during lockdown, but we didn't really choose to be that unproductive. We were doing our civic duty and didn't even draw a dick on something, which is considered a real win in Australian terms of doing your civic duty. According to Australian Council of Trade Unions President Michelle O'Neill, this $800 backslide is the steepest cut in real terms for more than 20 years. Can't blame the war on that. This happened before the war was even an inclusion on Putin's USSR vision board. Wage rises have consistently undershot budgetary forecasts, even as unemployment rates have fallen, which is supposed to be a key indicator of wages going up. The idea being, in times of low unemployment, the demand for labor by employers exceeds the supply, right? That's supposed to be how it works. So, in such a tight labor market, employers typically need to pay higher wages to attract employees, ultimately leading to rising wage inflation and also rising inflation, employers whining that they need to pay their employees a reasonable rate of pay so that they can live and eat food. Or so it's supposed to go. Researchers, however, blame the weak wage growth in part on increased casualization of work, giving employees less clout when they bargain with bosses. Plus, if you complain too much, make waves, or try to unionize, they fabricate some complaints and then they fire you, as basically you have no rights due to being a casual employee. A tale as old as time. Michelle O'Neill has also said the cost of living issue has been compounded by 9 years of low wage growth, continued attacks on workers' rights and conditions, and the increases under this government of casual and insecure work. I'm looking at you, Deliveroo. The only thing you've been delivering is increasing unstable work conditions. And they took 60 minutes to arrive and were cold. 1 star, Deliveroo, 1 star. Since 2013, average wages have been growing at around 2% per year. That's the slowest sustained growth since the end of the Second World War. Wages have barely kept up with consumer prices in this time, which means that workers haven't had a real wage increase measured by increasing power of their incomes in 6 years. I know it feels like the COVID crisis has gone on for about a decade, but it was less than 3 years ago. And the war is really new, so we can't blame the fact that our dollar has no purchasing power on those either. Maybe the economy shouldn't be built more precariously than a Jenga tower, where an increase of one or two blocks, in this case represented by dollars per liter for needs, threatens to knock the whole system down. We should be able to weather this for more than a week without having to seriously consider taking on a bank loan just to be able to afford to get to work, to earn money to pay off the petrol that you use to get to work. Australia's wage trajectory changed dramatically beginning around 2013, when normal wage growth decelerated suddenly from traditional annual increases of 3.5 to 5% per year to an average of 2%. Since then, consequently, real wages have been stagnant. You might need to break it to your parents and grandparents gently, but while the cost of an avocado and a cup of coffee has increased, it is not the economic natural disaster that they seem to think it is. It is more that our wages are struggling to be as valuable. Ironically, paying us in peanuts may actually be more valuable, as at least the economic power of peanuts rises every year, whereas our wages risk dropping. Since the Liberal National Coalition took office in 2013, real living standards for Australians have stagnated, or for many, declined. While the decline is not solely due to the government's own wage-suppressing policies, which include such compassionate and helpful measures as capping public sector wage growth, attacking unions, underfunding public servants, and underfunding public services, and the removal of public holiday pay for many sectors, they definitely fucking made matters worse. And those of you who think it is maybe a coincidence, or maybe they aren't that malicious, need to remember when Finance Minister Matthias Cormann described downward flexibility in the rate of wage growth as a deliberate design feature of our economic architecture, saying the quiet part out loud as he continued saying, policies aimed at pushing wages up could cause massive spikes in unemployment. Now, this has proven untrue. Now, this has been proven untrue by Nobel Prize winning maths. And sure, we don't want to pay attention to maths that isn't E equals MC squared or the occasional reference to Pythagoras. That's about all the maths that we care to mention in public without risking our status as totally cool and not at all a maths dork. But just quickly, for those who didn't see the episode in which we discussed this previously, in an influential article in 1994, later expanded into a book, David Card and Alan Kruger examined a natural experiment. In 1992, the US state of New Jersey increased its minimum wage to be the highest in the US, whereas its neighboring state of Pennsylvania did not. They found no indication that the rise in the minimum wage cost any jobs. Not only that, Card and Kruger surveyed around 400 fast food outlets on either side of the state borders. They wanted to see whether there was any difference in the changes in the numbers of workers employed in the cities that were near each other but differed only in what they had done to the minimum wage, and found that restaurant employment in New Jersey increased while it decreased in Pennsylvania. Weird, right? That people were more keen to get better paying jobs? That's so strange. It just makes no sense, you know? As someone in the arts, I am under the impression that people who work for experience and the joy of work, not for financial restitution. Or at least, that's my lived experience. Please come and see my comedy festival shows. Please, please, please. For more than 40 years, both the architecture of the labour market regulation and the dissectionary choices of the government have been designed with the precise objective of holding wages down, like a bag of puppies in a river. Is that too much? Like a bag of kittens in a river. I know you guys don't like cats all that much. It's fine. Instead, the decline in the wage share of total income has been variously blamed on technology, immigration, imports from China, and more recently, the end of the mining boom, or as they're more commonly known, the four horsemen of the economic apocalypse. This isn't new. On its election in 1996, the Howard government introduced Workplace Relations Act 1996, which extended scope for non-union agreements, unions being one of the biggest drivers of benefits and wage gains for employees. Then, after winning a Senate majority in 2004, Howard introduced Work Choices, which limited the scope of collective bargaining and would back protections against dismissal. Oh, the titular choice, of course, being shut up and suck it up or get fired. A fair and balanced choice, if ever there was one. The organisations created by the Abbott and Turnbull governments, the Registered Organisations Commission and Australian Building and Construction Commission, have been somewhat less subtle about their anti-union stances, and as such have repeatedly broken the laws that they are supposed to uphold. Which actually opens up the door for a few of them to maybe join the police force. They always need a few rogue cops who aren't afraid to bend the rules for justice. It is worth noting, while Labour governments have wound back some of the most extreme measures, they have not changed the general direction of the policy. So keep that in mind. At least we can put to bed the macroeconomic management idea that any increase in wages is a danger, requiring a tightening of fiscal and monetary policy, like the time Employment Minister Eric Abetz in January 2014, months after taking office, that said that Australia faced a wages explosion. leading to multiple years of unnecessary fear-mongering training for citizens in the event of the threat of a wages explosion, to duck and cover under our desks to maximize the unlikelihood of panicking and minimize the likelihood of us rioting in panic. But sadly, it never came to be. Which is a real problem because, according to Philip Lowe, the head of the Reserve Bank of Australia, low pay rises actually harm the economy more than low house prices. Not just because you can't negatively gear your lost wages against your new, much lower income and write off the difference, but because, as always, there are more of us poor than there are of anybody else. A fact always worth keeping in mind when you're struggling to move your guillotine on your own. They will try to convince you this is all new and nobody could have seen it coming. But it has been here all along. We just ignored it, like the cries of women hoping to be heard. All the way back in the heady days of the distant past, 2019, Australia's economy, as documented by Michael West and the Sydney Morning Herald, tumbled to an all-time low relative to the rest of the developed world. In June, the ABS national accounts showed Australia was in the worst wages slump relative to total earnings since records were first published in 1959. That was a long time ago. Even further back than most of us think, because you're like thinking it's about 50 years ago. But it was 70. 70 years ago. That's one standard grandpa as measured in the old system. Independent Australia showed Australia had the best performing economy throughout the period 2009 to 2013. Now, why did those years feel so familiar? Who was running the show then? Yeah, but you're right, those parties, they're exactly the same. No possible difference between them all. Sharpen your pencils, Australia. It's time to draw some dicks on a ballot paper. And if you want to try something new, you can slap a vulva on your old ballot paper. Because I think change is good. And that is the end of the show. Thanks so much for hanging around if you did, and thanks for listening, taking a chance on sticking it out to the end and listening to this old plug. Do please come to the show at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. Sorry, my brain's melting. Come to the Comedy Festival. My show is Wage Against the Machine. If you enjoy this kind of work, you will love it. It is satirical. It is complaining about the government. It is a bunch of my old jobs that didn't treat me right. It is rubber debt, it is wage theft, it is work cover, it is all these good things that are terrible things, but good things for comedy, I guess. And then if you're in Edinburgh in August, come find me. I will know nobody there. Come find me and see my show. I Got Bit by a Monkey Once, my storytelling show. I'm actually quite looking forward to putting it back on. I feel like it's going to be a good chance to reconnect with that old material. But Wage Against the Machine is happening, and it is an excellent show. Just come on down. Thanks a lot. Keep safe. Look after yourselves. Get vaccinated if you haven't. Get your booster. What do we need to do at the moment? Yeah, stay safe. Bye.